Good evening and welcome to the second of the Miliband Lectures on Culture in the Age of Global Communications. Good evening to you all, welcome to you all, and above all, of course, welcome to Emmanuel Castells. It's a great honour and privilege for us to have you this evening here, and we're really delighted that you could come. Now, most of you probably already know a lot about Emmanuel Castells' background and work, so I won't go over his extraordinary record of achievement at any length, but just a very few things. He is research professor of the Information Society at the Open University of Catalonia in Barcelona, and also the Wallace Annenberg Professor of Communication and Technology and Society at the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. He has published widely, extremely widely, including 20 books and over 100 substantial articles, and I'm leaving out most of the other articles, which were not in a sense in their own right individual contributions, but at least 100 articles, which were in some sense theoretically or empirically path-breaking contributions. Among his various distinctions and awards, he was appointed to the European Academy in 1994 and was a member of the European Commission's high-level expert group on the Information Society in 1995 to 97. He's been an advisor to UNESCO, the ILO, the United Nations Development Programme, and the governments of Chile, Mexico, France, Ecuador, the Russian Federation, Brazil, Portugal, and Spain, among others. Among his books, which many of you no doubt know about and have read, are The Internet Galaxy, Oxford University Press, 2001, and his great trilogy, The Information Age, Economy, Society, and Culture, which he began to publish in 1996. I could go on. The list of his achievements is really, truly remarkable. So remarkable, in fact, that when I was thinking about them last night and wondering what I might say today, a song kept on bursting into my head. And I'll just give you a clue. The clue is Tina Turner. And I wonder whether anyone can think of the line that would be most fitting to introduce Emmanuel Castells with. Well, I'll tell you what it is. You're simply the best, better, better, better than all the rest. I checked the lyrics today on the internet, and it's probably best I stop there. That's the framing quote, and the rest would probably get me into some trouble. Certainly create more questions than need to be raised now. So on Tina Turner's introduction, Emmanuel, we welcome you here. Join with me to a warm welcome to Emmanuel Castells.
Thanks very much, David, for your wonderful introduction. I'm going to change my mind and now think that the Hollywood culture really has permeated down to the LSE.
Tina Turner is far greater.
So, but more seriously, I truly thank you, David, for your invitation, and to you, the LSE. And let me just say that I am extremely proud of being able to associate my name, even for an evening, to the name of Ralph Miliband and to this towering figure of the social sciences, which was one of my basic readings in my young age. And I always remember that great debate in the 1970s that was remember as the Miliband-Poulantzas debate between Miliband and my friend, colleague, and almost brother, Nikos Poulantzas. That was a very exciting debate, which years later, I thought that Miliband was right in that debate. And I would say that probably the last works of Nikos before his death were moving into the direction of Miliband's theory to some extent. But regardless of who was right, what was extraordinary was the level and the intensity and the relevance of that political theory debate, which only now rarely we find in some of the great political theories such as David Held himself, but in general this world dominated by rational choice theories and other similar formal theories, should learn from the great tradition of Miliband. I will lecture today on the relationship between power and politics in the network society. And let me explain a little bit before going into the subject of the matter. Power is the most fundamental process in society, of course, because society is defined around values and institutions, and what is valued and what is institutionalized depends on power relationships. So this is the founding structure of society, if you wish. Power, in very simple terms, is the structural capacity to impose one's will over another's will. Politics refers, of course, to the set of practices directly aimed at exercising power or contesting and negotiating the exercise of power. And power and politics exist, of course, in all societies. But the conditions of their existence, the conditions of the exercise of power, are historically, culturally, and institutionally specific. Therefore, power and politics are subjected in their specific forms to the transformational effects that take place in technology, in economy, in culture, in communication, so that this multidimensional transformation takes place in a dynamic, interactive process which is enacted and fought over by social actors. And these social actors are defined by opposing interests and values. So this is the general frame of political analysis. But if we take this seriously to the end, that means that if there is a transformation of the multidimensional transformation of society, as I think can be argued takes place in our society in the last two decades, therefore, political management and political change are also specific to this kind of society, which in our case, I think, it's can be related to the transformation that I have theorized as the rise of the network society. So I shall start first by focusing on the crisis of political systems that is taking place around the world. And then my argument is that at the roots of this crisis are the contradictions surrounding the emergence of a new form of politics, informational politics, contradictions that are themselves the result of a new specific form of power, the power of networks. In other words, the process of power and politics is to some extent redefined under the conditions of the network society. To which extent and through which kind of processes is what I will try to argue in the lecture. But let's start simply by reminding you, and I apologize in advance for the elementary character of this observation, reminding you about the existence of a worldwide crisis of political legitimacy. And I will try to show how this crisis of political legitimacy is connected to the deeper structural process of transformation in the exercise of power and politics. Crisis of political legitimacy in the most elementary sense, that is, a complete lack of trust of citizens on their governments and on the mainstream political parties and on the political class in general. I remind you, in the year 2000, Kofi Annan Commission for the Millennium Assembly of the United Nations, a worldwide survey to the Gallup Institute on 65,000 interviews. They say representative sample of the world population. I don't know how they do that, but well, anyway, looks like it's a lot of people anyway. In that survey, 62% of citizens in the world, including those in the advanced democracies, said that they were not governed by the will of the people. In one of the key questions and many other questions along the similar way. In 2002, the World Economic Forum repeated the same Gallup survey at the world level, and this time the proportion had increased to 66% of the citizens in the world distrusting their governments, literally saying that they were not governed by their will, and a whole battery of indicators in the same way. In last year, with one of my students, Steve Oye, who is now a graduate student at LSE, we did a compilation of data from surveys around the world on different countries and different cultures. All the data point into the same direction: complete lack of trust in the political system by citizens in the world at large. Certain reputation of politicians, when you have reputational surveys on different occupations, the last one, that last, is always politician in every country. In Italy, they are even, in Italy they include in the survey mafiosi and prostitutes, and they rank better than politicians. When people were asked why, they said, well, at least they say what they do. Now, I don't think this is good news, and it sounds funny, but it's not. I think it's profoundly worrisome, because after all, that's what we have, representative democracy. But as a fact, let's start with a fact, a deep crisis of political democracy. In California, by the way, opinion polls collected in 1998, 2002, by the Field Institute of California, showed that while in the United States people distrust their government in a proportion of 65%, in California it's 75%, 39% of California citizens consider that politicians in California are crooks. The word is crooks in the survey. So against this background, the victory of the recall campaign last year in California and the election of the Terminator was not a shift to the right. Listen to that. It's not a shift to the right, because in many other surveys and values, people vote consistently for values to the left of the mainstream of the United States. But was a vote to terminate the political class, with all kind of implications, of course. The consequences of these trends on political behavior and political attitudes vary depending upon countries and institutional systems. But they are powerful in all cases. They have very powerful effects, except that different manifestations depending on the system and on the moment. One of the consequences is low voter turnout. Remember, in the United States, barely about 50% in the presidential elections, 40% in the congressional elections, 10 to 30% of the voters in the local elections. There is declining voter turnout in most other democracies, including in the UK last year in the local elections, mainly as an expression of distrust by Labour Party voters against Blair's policies in Iraq, that reflected in, since the alternative vote was difficult then, it reflected in the low voter turnout. But this is not the only expression of the kind of political legitimacy. In some cases, an exceptional case, there is a strong mobilization to vote against a government for some particularly dramatic reason, as it was precisely the case last week in Spain, with 79% participation rate in a process which I think is very indicative of many new trends, and I will comment on it later in the lecture. People also vote against, not for, to prevent a bad candidate or to punish a government. And as a rule, most elections nowadays, the votes are against, not for. Protest votes for candidates with extreme positions is another way to respond, even if they cannot win, or I would say precisely because they cannot win. So it's a way to protest. That was the case, for instance, in the famous French presidential elections of 2002, and almost this led to Le Pen winning the presidential election by surprise. Although the main issue, in fact, in that case was not that Le Pen advanced so much. In fact, he got 2 points more than the previous election, 2 points of percentage more, to 17%. The main issue was the Trotskyite vote and the ecologist vote that took away votes from the Socialist Party. The two Trotskyite vote list was 12% together. I said to my friends in the French Socialist Party, if Jospin would have remained a Trotskyite, would have won the election. Or in the Netherlands, the Pin for Twin phenomenon. And as a whole, in Europe, you look Europe 2001, 2003, you have a consistent trend of increasing vote for third-party candidates, protest candidates, radical candidates, and just watch the next regional elections in France in the coming days, because there's a huge surge of vote, both for the extreme right and for the extreme left. And certainly, one of the most significant trends, in my opinion, the younger the voter in every country, the greater the dissatisfaction, the disaffection and dissatisfaction vis-a-vis traditional political parties. On the other hand, mainstream political parties have become political machines in practically all countries. They are empty shells to support candidates. In terms of membership, they're only members which average age probably 45. They are people who are there for their, as a way to make a living or a career. At the same time, there is also, together with the crisis of political legitimacy, there is an increasing process of individualization and in society and decline of traditional forms of civic participation and civic commitment. This is the Robert Putnam theme, but has been replicated in a number of studies in other countries. Now, this does not mean that there is an end to social mobilization. This is different, and I will come to this later. It's a decline in the traditional forms of civic participation in trade unions, in neighborhood associations, in block clubs, in all kind of formal organization of participation in political life, not in social mobilization. In fact, Ronald Engelhardt has showed with his analysis on the worldwide study on the World Value Survey that at the same time there is a decline in political participation, formal political participation, a decline in formal civic participation, and an increase in social mobilization and social struggles and protests. So these are two different trends. NGOs, yes, are very important, and particularly in the international arena, but remember, NGOs, I call them usually neo-governmental organizations, because most NGOs are, to some extent, funded, supported by some kind of government. So for me, NGOs nowadays are a form of decentralization of the state and a form of the new particular institutional system, the network state. Therefore, there is a growing gap between citizens and the political system. Vote is mainly to the lesser of two evils, or is focused on single issues. There is an increase in political cynicism, but not the end of ideology. It's the end of trust, and that's a different matter. I would say simply that empirically speaking, the Scandinavian countries fare better in terms of trust and democracy. But in terms of trend, the trend is also toward declining participation and declining trust, except that the level of trust is much, much higher than in any other political system, although there is a significant rise of xenophobic vote in Denmark and Norway, and similar trends coming up in Sweden and Finland. So, that's where we are. But how can we relate this to something else? My argument here is that it's a worldwide trend and consistent and increasing over the last 10 years. So it's something else than a simple problem here or there in one particular country or culture. So let's go into another level of analysis, trying to see the institutional, some of the institutional causes for this phenomenon, and then I will go later on into a deeper structural level of social change to relate to both the institutional level and to the behavioral level. At the institutional level, I think one first phenomenon that can be related to this crisis is the crisis of the nation-state itself in the process of globalization. We know now that there is no such a thing as the end of the nation-state, the disappearance of the state, all these ideologies, both radical and neoliberal are now being put to rest by empirical analysis. David and McGrew and other people have investigated this in depth for a number of years, Hurt and Thompson as well. But what is true is that the process of globalization has undermined the capacity of the nation state to act, to manage key processes that shape citizens' lives: global finance, currency control, transnational transnational production, labor issues, all become globally defined beyond the realm of the nation state. Under this condition, there is a growing difficulty to preserve the welfare state in a condition of global open markets unless there is a substantial increase of productivity and then a redistribution of this productivity growth, as the case of Finland shows quite clearly. At the same time, open markets, global open markets, affect specific interests: farmers, manufacturing, but also increasingly services and high tech, the current massive outsourcing of service, advanced services, and high tech jobs from advanced countries to the countries of the developing world. Global communications is dominated by major media groups that extend their control to much of the internet server providers. So to a large extent, states are not able to, in spite of the regulatory power, to control global communication. Global transnational science and technology networks work quite independently from the control capacity of the state. Certainly, the global criminal economy continues to expand and weakens state institutions throughout the world. And on the other hand, on the one hand, the state has less capacity to control, manage, and regulate. Doesn't disappear, but has less capacity. And on the other hand, the more people feel lost and unprotected in globalization, the more they relate to their specific identities, to their national, regional, ethnic, religious, gender identities. For instance, as it's shown in the most reliable source on a comparative basis, which is the World Value Survey of the University of Michigan. Just to mention the territorial frame of reference, the data from this survey show that when people are asked to choose their predominant identity in terms of local, regional, one category, national or cosmopolitan, of course, cosmopolitan identity is a minority of people, is 15%. But the most important figure is that 38% refer to the nation state as their predominant frame of reference, while 47% rely mainly on their local or regional identity. And by the way, the highest percentage of regional local predominant identity is in southwestern Europe, 64%, and northwestern Europe, 62%. However, the nation state, and that is challenged by this double crisis of globalization and identification, does not disappear, adapts to it. It's not such a thing as the crumbling of the nation state. The nation states have reacted by decentralizing and relating to a process of devolution of power to regional, local governments and NGOs, and at the same time by forming supranational institutions to share sovereignty and to enhance their common chances to manage globalization, the European Union, of course, being the most clear example of this matter. But also NATO, also the increasing involvement of the United Nations, the IMF, the World Bank, and a myriad of international agreements and international institutions. So what has happened in the process, and I go fast on this because it's an analysis that I have developed for quite a while already, what happens in this process is ultimately the nation state does not disappear, but it becomes a node of a different form of a state, what I call the network state, which is form of a series of connections between nation states cooperating with each other, local and regional governments, on the other hand, NGOs, and then supranational and international institutions. And the actual exercise of government and politics works on the basis of all these connections between different levels of agencies constantly interconnecting, negotiating, dominating or resisting to domination. This is the complexity of the state nowadays, that network state, which is at the same time global, national and local, and also links up to the organizations of the civil society through the NGOs. Problem is that this network state becomes somewhat more effective, at least this is the hypothesis, in managing problems that go beyond the scope of the nation state boundaries. But on the other hand, it is increasingly difficult to maintain the mechanism of political representation in the complexity of these levels and interactions. Example, remember the slogan of the protest movement in Seattle in December 1991. What was the unifying slogan? No to globalization without representation. Of course, picking up on the American Revolution slogan of no representation, no taxation without representation. Now, what happens there? The answer from government, so what is it? What? Why not representation? We are democratically elected governments. You are represented in the WTO. The WTO represents governments which are representing people. The notion there is, wait a second, by the time you have finished negotiation in these closed rooms between all these governments in the world, elected every 4 years on the basis of some media gimmicks, that's the argument, I'm not saying that. Where is my representation? I don't see my representation. In other words, the traditional critique of the process of representation through democracy, through vote, one vote between two parties every 4 years, becomes incredibly more complicated and indirect when all these processes of representation are networked and related to each other in a space which is not democratically defined. It's managerially defined, it's not democratically defined. Second institutional transformation, which I think it could explain part of the crisis of legitimacy. The technology of politics. The technology of politics, that is the instrumentality of politics nowadays, is dominated, as we know, by media politics. Media, in the broadest sense, are the mechanism of formation of public opinion in all spheres of life. So politics is processed and defined in the media space, particularly under the condition of the decline of political parties and the decline of civil society organizations. Media are the new public space. This is critical. The new public space is the media. This is the end of the Habermasian world of the Constitution as creating the public space. The public space is created by the media, particularly by television. And because television, remember, according to all survey data in every country, except in Catalonia, by the way, it's the most credible source of political information. Why? Obvious. People see it. If you see it, it's true, right? Well, wrong, as all the media experts and TV editors know. But it's all fiction. But people see it, so that's hard evidence. Now, it does not mean, what I just said, that media hold the power. But what it means is that all politics is ultimately media politics, in the sense that it works on a binary model. You are in the media, you relate to society. You are not in the media, you are marginal. You don't exist in the public political space. It doesn't mean that protest movements are not possible. It means that ultimately, the way to relate to the society at large is to impact the media and to be present in the media in some way. So it's not the power of the media per se, that's another issue. Sometimes yes, sometimes not. In Italy, yes. It would be very difficult to argue about pluralism in the media in Berlusconi's Italy. Fortunately, the BBC, we know, is a very independent and uncontrolled public media institution, so it's no problem there. But ultimately, this is not the issue. The issue is that media, because of competitive structures in the media, they are plural to a large, to some extent, within some range. The issue is that everybody or everything that has to be processed politically in the public space has to go through the language of the media and in the media setting. So is the power is in the media networks, not in the media ownership. Now, the media ownership is one of the factors determining the media networks. But Murdoch cannot do everything he wants. He would like, but there are some limits. Still, we are not in the complete media dictatorship. And neither Murdoch or Berlusconi can dictate everything in the media, among other things, because they're professional journalists and professional media people. Now, the important matter in political terms, then, is that the existence of any project or proposal in the media is the precondition for political projects or images to reach people's minds and ultimately citizens' vote. Now, under the conditions of media politics, the important thing is how to use messages that impact people's mind. What is a credible message in the media language has to be simple enough to be able to reach people. Cannot be a political program. There are some studies that ask people, surveys that ask people if they read the political platforms of parties before voting. Results, less than 3%. And ask yourself, if you read the political program of a party, you read maybe the headlines of what the media tell you about what this party says about such and such question, but not the political program per se. So what is the key issue is credibility. Credibility is personalized. The easiest message in the world of media politics is a personality, is a figure, is an image, is a face and a life, or the fiction of a life. Therefore, the most important weapon in media politics is to destroy the message that is the personality of the opponent. Why? Because studies in political advertising show that negative advertising is 5 times more effective than positive advertising. It refers to a traditional thing in the media world, only bad news are news. News of the kind, oh, what a wonderful day today, it's sunny, you are going to be happy today. No one would believe it, first of all, and no one would read it. But your prime minister lied again, yes, then the people would read it. Now, because of negative advertising is critical, then media politics has been predicated on the destruction of the legitimacy of everybody. And since everybody does it, ultimately everybody goes down together. Now, lately, in the last 5 or 6 years, has been so much negative advertising that now new technology has developed. How to show how negative is the advertising of your opponent? So it's a second derivative, you see? Now it has a bad reputation to be negative. So now is to accuse the other of being negative, which is another form of negativism, of course. The other issue is be careful by identifying this to the fact that destroying image is always through the same system. Destroying image by accusing someone of extramarital sex works well in the Anglo-Saxon Puritan culture. It works the other way around in the Spanish or French culture. So it depends. Corruption scandals in Spain or France is about money, here is about sex. So the political management through the media refers to also to something else. Increasingly, governments of all kind and of all political persuasions try to fabricate information and manipulate information to influence public opinion as a constant political practice, as in the obvious case the last year in the Iraq war around the world. Third institutional transformation is the politics of a scandal, which John Thompson has so brilliantly analyzed in his book. The scandal politics, which is the form of politics nowadays, has to be placed, as he does, in the symbolic manipulation in a world dominated by media politics. Because if you take the Longman's handbook on political corruption, such a thing, there is a history of scandals and there is a statistical series of scandals and political corruption. Or you take more recently Transparency International, which has a very good website for the last 7 years on political corruption in every country. Both sources show that it's not necessarily more political corruption now than before. So not that we are doing well, it's that we always did badly. So there is a lot of political corruption, but the statistics go up and down. It's not at least reported political corruption. It's something else. It's the uses of corruption as part of the political game. That's a much more systematic development in recent years. But also something else. The financing of politics, of media politics, and of informational politics has become very expensive. Media politics is extremely expensive because it's not just linked to the electoral campaigns. Electoral campaigns are the least important part of media politics. Is to the constant relationship to the media on an ongoing basis, and that's very expensive. And it's not simply advertising. It's paying these journalists, financing this television network. It's all kind of indirect connections. Now, financing of political parties throughout the world is hypocritically low. To some extent, parties have to expend much more money than they have in legal terms. So they take it from other sources, of course. In my personal experience and the studies I have done here and there, I don't know any political party, anyone, that doesn't practice illegal financing. Of course, in the case of the United States, this is to a maximum. But every election year, there's a new discussion about the reform, the finance reform for political parties every year. But here is the problem. The same politicians who depend on this particular type of financing have to vote the laws to control financing. And they don't. They certainly don't. Every year they kill it in the Congress. Everybody defends the reform, but everybody votes against. Only McCain, the Republican senator, has been consistent in the United States on this matter. So, political corruption, politics of scandal, and political financing are closely tied together. Now, you take together the increasing crisis of efficiency of the network state and the difficulty to translate the process of political representation in the network state. The media politics as the way to personalize politics, and the politics of corruption and politics of scandal all together are major institutional sources of the crisis of political legitimacy. So ultimately, the discourse based on principles becomes increasingly theatrical and unreliable. In such context, people build their own individual strategies. Trust is broken. And democracy becomes a defensive principle. By this I mean, democracy is still very important and people all over the world support democracy, but which kind of democracy? The democracy that we could go into, the famous theory starting with Locke and other political philosophers, but I think the most direct expression is what the French philosopher and journalist Robert Escarpy defined democracy a few years ago, 20 years ago. Democracy is when someone knocks in your door at 5 a.m. and you think it's the milkman. So that level of democracy is extremely popular and is but it's a defensive principle. Is it the individual approach of democracy? The government is so rotten that don't touch me. It's clear that it's personal control rather than political representation. This kind of attitude toward government and democracy is all right when there are no major issues in society. People just want peace and to be able to go on with their lives, period. And don't bother me too much. But in case of crisis, economic crisis, crisis of public service, geopolitical crisis, terror, or in case of uncertainty, globalization, the construction of Europe without knowing exactly why and how, the multicultural transformation of society, mass migration, when people panic, then they resort to demagogues because the political market is there to be taken. Unless they take matters in their hands and insert by themselves, as I will try to argue toward the end of the lecture. Now, if we go deeper, not only into the institutional transformation, but into the structural transformation of society, how can we relate these transformations to the exercise of power in what I have called the network society? Well, you have been so kind to me that I will not inflict upon you another definition and analysis of the network society, since I already sent you 3 volumes on the matter. If you are really interested, you can go again into these volumes. But I would like to build on this. I would like to try to see in such a context how power is exercised. And what I'm going to present now is work in progress, so take it such as an experimental attempt to make sense of the current transformations and things that have not been published yet. And in fact, it's the first time that I present these pre-thoughts in public. I would say that the context of the network society means, to some extent, that we are in a society in which all domains and all activities of social practice are organized around electronically power networks. The network society is global, because networks, by definition, have no boundaries. But it doesn't mean that it includes everything everywhere. It means that all societies are integrated into some global networks of function and power, which at the same time live outside these networks, everything that is not valued according to the programs of the networks. So to start with, there are 2 processes of domination or power making. The first one is the exclusion from the dynamics of this globally interrelated network society. That is, the first mechanism of domination, you are in, you are out. That's the first mechanism of domination. The distance between being in the network or being outside the network is infinite. The second mechanism is within the networks that constitute, on a global scale, the network society. Under these conditions, how power is defined and exercised in the world of networks? Well, the one thing we know is that power is not rooted solely or mainly in the institutions of the state. Citing David Held's work in his seminal article in 1991, I quote exactly, "The international order today is characterized by the persistence of the sovereign state system and the development of plural authority structures at the same time. The objections to such a hybrid system are severe." This is, I would say, even more so nowadays, as David himself has stated in his recent work. And this is mainly because, in terms of the sovereign state, we are down to 1, the United States, and in fact with much less autonomy than the Bush administration seems to think. But also because the plurality of sources of power has greatly diversified in terms of spheres, economic power, media power, technology power, religion, but also in terms of organizational and institutional levels, local and regional states, international institutions, NGOs, networks of activism. So in this extremely fragmented structure, what is power in the networks? Let me here introduce briefly some theoretical considerations. Let's first see power in the networks, and then the second and last question I will deal with is power and counterpower in the network society. In the network society, the first fundamental mechanism, as I said, of domination is the exclusion of the networks that constitute the dominant elements of the network society. But who has power in the dominant networks? And who has the power to configure the network state in excluding segments of other societies? In the last resort, there is power, remember, when regardless of the will of someone, a person, social group, a category of people, an organization, a country, regardless of the will of this someone, it must submit to the will of the power holders, or else exposed to violence. Under these conditions, in the network society, in the world of networks, the problem is that the question of power holding could be either very simple or impossible to answer. And let me explain. Very simple. Each network defines its own power system depending on the program goals of the network. So, in global capitalism, the global financial market has the last word, and the IMF becomes its authoritative interpreter, usually with the word that is spoken in the language of the US Treasury Department, but occasionally with German, French, or Oxbridge accent. Or in state military power, sure, this is just the power of the United States. Or in more analytical terms, the power of any apparatus able to harness technological innovation in the pursuit of military power. And this is essentially the United States. All other military powers in the world are simply not relevant, except in terms of the nuclear balance that could be used by some states. Now, so in that sense, who has power in the world, in the network society, becomes a very simple empirical question to identify in each network who has the power, but in each network. On the other hand, the question could become an analytical dead end if we try to answer unidimensionally, that is, the source of power as a single entity. In other words, if we try to say, well, yes, but the United States at the same time, they are the source of military power, the source of financial power, well, no, no, no. Military power could not prevent the catastrophic financial crisis, and in fact could actually make it worse by creating geopolitical conditions in which investors run away from the market. Or global financial markets can be seen, as I have tried to argue and other people argued in the volume that we published with Tony Giddens and Will Hutton 4 years ago, can be seen as being out of control of any major financial institution and led by turbulences of information. Or political decision making can be said to be dependent on the media, and the media constitute a relatively plural ground. Or the capitalist class does have some power, but not the power, because it's highly dependent both on the dynamics of global markets and, on the other hand, on the decisions of governments that still can regulate and design policies. And governments themselves are linking complex networks of imperfect global governance, submitted to some extent to reactions from their citizens, periodically assailed by social movements and by expressions of resistance that do not recede easily in the back room of the end of history. So maybe under such condition, the question of power, as traditionally formulated, either dissolves hopelessly or does not make sense in the network society. But on the other hand, we know that domination is a major trend of any historically known society. So how this domination is exercised, how power is exercised in the world of networks. To make very complex things simple, I would present a hypothesis that is related mainly to two basic mechanisms. The first is the capacity to program and reprogram the network or the networks, each network, in terms of the goals that the programmers assign to this network. I'm talking about mechanism, therefore. Second, the ability to connect different networks to ensure their cooperation by sharing common goals and increasing resources through this sharing. I call the holders of the first power position the programmers, and the holders of the second power position the switchers, the ones that switch different networks. It's important to say that both programmers and switchers are certainly social actors. They're not entities, they're not robots. They are social actors. But these social actors are not necessarily one particular actor. They may be networks of actors themselves. They are not consciousless, abstract networks. They are not automata. They are humans organized around projects and interests, but they are not single actors, individuals, classes, religious leaders, political leaders. They are networks of actors cooperating to program the network and to connect this network to other networks. Let's examine more specifically these two mechanisms. The programming capacity of the goals of the network is of course decisive, because once a network, electronically powered, globally extended, has a program and a goal, it's an extremely efficient machine. I used to say, my analysis, networks have no personal feeling. Kill or kiss, no problem. You program me, I do the job for you. So how actors of different kinds achieve the programming of the network is a process specific to each network. So the mechanism is to program the network in a way that the network can then bring forward the instructions. But the particular program depends on the particular network and on the power holders of that network. In the global financial markets, the key is to reach the level of consensus in programming the global financial market to maximize profit throughout the world in terms of financial investment. It was not necessarily the case. Before the 1987 Big Bang in the city of London, there were all kind of regulations and different levels of institutional arrangements in the financial market. So the first programmers of the global financial markets were not the financial institutions, were not the companies, were the governments. The governments were the globalizers. The governments programmed the financial networks to follow the rule of making the best, quickest buck anywhere in the world without resorting to any other rule. So how actors and networks of actors program networks becomes specific to each network. However, there is something in common here where I want to insist on the mechanism. These programs are generated with ideas, visions, projects. They are cultural materials. In the network society, culture is by and large embedded in the processes of communication, in the electronic hypertext, with the media and the internet and wireless communication at its core. So ideas are maybe generated from a variety of origins and linked to specific interests and subcultures. Religious fundamentalism, neoclassical economics, the cult of individual freedom, and the like. But all these ideas are ultimately processed, socialized, and transmitted in the realm of communication. Ultimately, they reach the constituencies of each network on the basis of the exposure of these constituencies to the processes of communication. This seems to be very abstract. It means simply, before organizing the entire financial system around the premise of pure liberal neoclassical economics, first, you have to convince people that this is the best thing you can do in the world. Okay? It, it means simply what used to be called the one way of thinking in the social movement. This means that ideological, it's an old idea, ideological hegemony precedes the ability to program the networks. In other words, the process of communication in society and the organization of this process of communication, often the media but not only, can also be economic think tanks, can be the World Economic Forum at Davos. These fields of communication are where the programming projects are formed and where constituencies are built for these projects. These are the fields of power in the network society. There is, however, a second source of power, which I would say is even more decisive. These are the controllers of the connecting points between various strategic networks. These are the switchers. For instance, the connection between the political leadership networks, the media networks, the technology networks, and the military and security networks in developing a joint geopolitical strategy. These connections are what makes possible to develop a much more powerful project. Isolated networks have a very fragile power. It's the connection between networks that creates a system of domination. Or else, the relationship between religious networks and political networks to advance a religious agenda in the secular society. Or between academic networks and business networks to exchange knowledge and legitimation against jobs for their graduate students. So these specific systems of interface that are set on a stable basis, these are the ways to articulate the operating system of society beyond the formal self-representation of institutions and organizations. Switchers are not persons, but they are made of persons. They are actors, but made of networks of actors which engage in dynamic interfaces specifically operated in each particular process of connection. Programmers and switchers are those actors and networks of actors that, because of their position in the social structure, are able to exercise their power in the network society. But we know that societies, and this is not the exception, are not made simply of domination, are also made of resistance to domination. So power and counterpower coincide in the network society. Processes of power making can be seen from two perspectives. On the one hand, seizing and enforcing power. On the other hand, resisting to power on behalf of interests, values, and projects that are excluded or underrepresented in the programs of the dominant networks. Analytically, both processes configure the power structure through their interaction. But they are distinct, yet they operate through the same logic. Means that the resistance to power is also operated through the programming and reprogramming of the networks of power and through the disconnection of the connections that have been established by power. For instance, the reprogramming of global financial networks means that the ability to calculate an investment depends on new forms of regulation that include what can be invested or cannot be invested. When activists, social movements, try to introduce new regulations in the World Trade Organization saying, save the dolphins. Well, that's a reprogramming of the network, even if it is too much of a simple case. The ability to incorporate new values, new projects into what can be actually processed in the networks is actually not only regulation, it's new values connected to these networks. For instance, when Nike suddenly is faced with a consumer movement that protests against the exploitation of children in the world, and this affects the value of stocks in the global financial market, this is a reprogramming of the sources of calculation in the global financial markets. In other words, while most of the activity in traditional forms of power making were concentrated in the exercise of power through the state and the resistance to power by influencing directly the state. What I'm now trying to say is that what we observe in recent years is that cultural movements, changes of values in society by the capacity of social actors to change the dominant values of society, translate into different networks of power, modifying the programs of these networks. What can be done or cannot be done with women, with children, with ecological preservation, etc. More radical reprogramming comes from resistant movements aimed at altering the fundamental principle of the network. For instance, or if you wish, the kernel of the program code, if you allow me to keep the parallel with our language. For instance, if God's will must prevail under all conditions, then the institutional networks that constitute the legal and judicial system must be reprogrammed. If Christian fundamentalists have their way, then the key issue is that women's rights on their body have to be submitted to the interpretation of God's will by its earthly bishops. In other instance, when the movement for global justice claims the rewriting of trade agreements managed by the World Trade Organization, then to include environmental conservation, social rights, this is acting on the program to modify the networks of the global economy. Second mechanism of resistance, blocking the switches of connection between networks. For instance, in the United States, the movement to avoid the current connection between the Federal Communication Commission and the oligopolistic business groups that are trying to concentrate in greater proportions their power over the media. Or blocking the networking between corporate business and the political system by regulating campaign finance. So, in addition, the radical disruption of the switchers also can be affect the materials infrastructure of the network society, computer networks, transportation networks, information. To some extent, the challenge of violent resistance, the challenge of terrorism, is precisely predicated on this capacity to target strategic material switches. Resistance to power programming the network is also enacted by information networks powered by information and communication technologies. As we know, the so-called anti-globalization movement, which is called this way by the media, not by the movement itself, is a global local network organized and debated in the internet and structurally switched on with the media network, that is, organizing actions that can be connected directly to the media networks so that they can relate to society in terms of the messages they send to society at large. It is the characteristic of the network society that both the dynamics of domination and the resistance to domination rely on network formation and network strategies of offense and defense. In fact, this is in coherence with what we have observed historically in industrial society. The large industrial factory that became the expression of vertical organized division of labor was also the ground for organizing for the labor movement that adopted this form of organization as source of its strength and realizing its consciousness and its ability to form unions and from their mass political parties. So the world of networks is also being transformed. The world of networks acting symbolically is also being transformed by resistance acting symbolically on networks. Ultimately, this capacity of people and citizens throughout the world to act by themselves on the basis of their ability to set up their own communication systems is what makes room for possible superseding of the crisis of legitimacy by introducing into the political system new forms of control that did not exist before. I cannot resist in ending to refer to the example that we just lived last week in Spain, in which for people who don't necessarily know about the matter, after the barbarian terrorist attack on Thursday, the government insisted that, and the British government also, without knowing anything, that was ETA, the Basque terrorist, have done it. And that, of course, had all kinds of political implications. The election could depend on who was actually behind this attack. They knew that there was Al-Qaeda very, very quickly. They tried to convince people, at least until Monday, after the election on Sunday, that was ETA, for kind of other reasons. Well, political parties hesitated. Some crazy people like myself wrote a major article in the newspaper saying it was Al-Qaeda for this and this and this reason. But the official line was still that was ETA. On Saturday morning, the day before the voting, young people started to say that was unacceptable. Young people who usually were not very enthusiastic about voting, and even less voting for the Socialist Party, whose average voter age is probably 30, and they started to call each other with SMSs and mobile and wireless communication, calling for the political demonstrations, which was completely illegal, because that was the day of reflection. But the first message said, great, that's the reflection day, and the government television bombarding us with lies. So we have to give our truth. This started a movement in which first a few hundred, then thousands, then tens of thousands of young people started to demonstrate all over Spain, forcing the government by the end of the day to acknowledge that was Al-Qaeda and not ETA. More than that, the impact of the slogan that was liars, liars, was decisive on the 2 million new voters that were going to vote the following day, and that usually vote much less than the other people, and this time voted much more. So that ultimately we measure cell phone traffic and SMS traffic went up by 20% on Saturday and 40% on Sunday. And in addition, this young group voted in a proportion unprecedented, and that completely changed the shift of power and ultimately destroyed the hegemony of the Conservative Party that had been predicated on the war on terrorism without mentioning all the information they had. This is something which is revealing of how the autonomy in communication and the formation of grassroots spontaneous networks becomes a decisive tool in re-grassrooting politics in a society in which communication is the public space and in which ultimately the ability to impact people's consciousness goes through these communication systems. So we will conclude, therefore, by saying that in the network society, power is redefined, but of course does not vanish. Neither do social struggles. Domination and resistance of domination change in character according to the specific social structure from where they originate and that they modify through their action. Power rules. Counterpowers fight. Networks process the contradictory programs while people try to make sense of the sources of their hopes and their fears. Thank you very much.
Well, before I take questions, if there are people who need to go because of the hour, please take this as an opportunity to depart before we start the round of questions. While some people are leaving, may I take this opportunity just to mention the forthcoming lectures in this series. They will all be on the LSE notice boards and websites, but I should just tell you about three. On May the 12th, we have Huang Hui here at the Old Theatre on the global impact of Chinese culture. On the 1st of June, we have Homi Bhabha lecturing on the title, A Global Measure, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Immensity. And on the 15th of June, Akbar Ahmed on the global impact of Islam and the new Islamic crises. So watch the website. If you could hurry up now, those exiting for various good reasons, it would be great, and then we'll start the questions. All right, those exiting, perhaps you could exit quietly, since you're still doing, and we'll start the questions. Can I see hands? Yeah. Where's the mic? Over there? Yeah. Please. Thank you. We take questions in classes of five, so be brief.
I was just wondering if the last example you gave on the way young people in Spain reacted to the behavior of their government, and it started some kind of almost spontaneous social action, is not a counter-argument to the point you advanced in the first part of your lecture when you said, well, this is the end of the public sphere as thought by Habermas. We're living a situation where only the media can really control public debate and process it in its own language. Isn't the case of Spain presenting perhaps some evidence that we still have some possibilities for regenerating public spheres beyond the constraints imposed by media and hegemonic power?
Downstairs, still? Hands?
Yes, well, thank you very much for what was a very interesting lecture. Again, to go back to your very last points, I share your optimism to some extent about the liberating potential of modern communication technologies. But I think we also have to keep in mind that these technologies of communications can also be technologies of control. And we're seeing very much, under the context, for example, of the war on terror, you use DARPA's Total Information Awareness Project, or Echelon, all sorts of, or even calls for new controls on the internet to prevent piracy and so on and so on. I think I'd like to hear your thoughts on the kind of dual nature of these technologies and how we can best avoid a slide into, you know, a technological totalitarianism of a certain sort. Thank you.
Hi, just a quick question. Back to the Spain thing again. It occurs to me that sort of shift due to technology, or the use of technology to perform that shift, is quite interesting. I was just wondering about, especially given that, say, younger people who probably aren't inclined to vote because of sort of various shades of grey in political parties are present, given that they're IT literate, and then also given, say, especially in countries with proportional representation, is there a chance in the next sort of 5 to 10 years that you would see, or how would you say, an election being won without people being on the doorsteps, being won through IT instead of using the sort of more conventional political means?
Hands up, yeah, please.
I would like to know are the relations of politics and power in the network society vis-a-vis the digital divide. How does that affect that? Because there's a major population which is still not have no access to network societies. So how would you think this power struggle would affect them? Thank you.
Manuel couldn't hear. Do you want to just repeat that? Thank you. Briefly.
I would just like to know the effect of politics and power in network society vis-a-vis the digital divide. What effect would it have on people who do not have access to internet as such?
The top, anyone else?
Yes.
Yeah, please.
Hello. This is part comment, part question, which I'd like you to address. But I find it amazing that you can recognize the media power structure networks that exist, but simultaneously fall into the trap of using the all-encompassing term Al-Qaeda, for example, which to me is ridiculous to assume every angry person from the Islamic world is somehow networked all the way from Indonesia to Afghanistan to Morocco. And yeah, I find that absurd. So if you could address that.
That's five. And you must be brief, too.
Sure. I think that the question about the end of the public sphere and or not the end is a very important one. It's not a question, actually. It's a very good contribution. What I really mean is that the public sphere defined institutionally is less and less able to process the political signals. In other words, what... the process, the crisis of legitimacy means that the new values, the new systems, the new projects that emerge in society have tremendous difficulty to be processed through formal politics in the way that is constitutionally defined. So it doesn't mean that elections are not important, but the way in which new projects, new ideas are formed that ultimately filter down through the institutional system to process of political decision making, this is increasingly external to the formal political institutions. Always, to some extent, social movements had been that, had been external sources that create new values and new projects. But what is characteristic now is that these new values, new projects, had been captured into the sphere of the media. Now, what I'm trying to show at the end is that ultimately, people by themselves can establish other systems of communication which are not captured either in the formal political system or in the informal politics of the media, which is another way of formalizing. In other words, the first public space migrated from the institutional sphere to the media sphere, but enclosed again political participation, excluding new values and new systems. The ability by people to build up their own networks of communication external to the system is one of the ways in which the system can process social change. That's the idea. And this is clearly the case in this particular case in which the Spanish youth didn't care about the socialists, care about lies and the war, and try to influence the political system on the basis of their own totally spontaneous mobilization. Technologies of control, absolutely. By definition, all technologies are used by the process of society, and the same technologies can be used for communication and for control, and for freedom and autonomy and control. However, what I would say, there's some built-in system in the internet type of network technology, which are quite fundamentally technologies of freedom, because they were designed in this way. They were culturally produced as technologies of freedom. So it doesn't mean that cannot be controlled by governments or by bureaucracies or by whoever, but the controlling apparatuses of power have been very good at controlling people's lives throughout history. So they don't stop to do that, and they use new technological means. But the ability to increase autonomy is much greater under these new kind of technologies, as I tried to show in the example. Yes, the FBI carnivore program can scan every possible dirty word, like democracy, etc., as they do in China. I mean, in China they scan. But look, China decided to control the internet. They can't. They can kill the messenger, but they cannot interrupt the message. Now, if you're the messenger, it's a little problem there. But the message goes on and diffuses, because it's literally impossible. And you know what the Chinese students do? They simply don't say democracy. By the way, it's not exactly the same thing in Chinese. So they simply don't use the dirty words. I mean, that's what in Spain 35 years ago we learned to do. Don't never use dirty words like democracy, socialism, and things like this. So election through IT, well, frankly, there has been a recent report in California, serious report of a Blue Ribbon panel showing that, in fact, one thing is to use the internet to actually increase political awareness, debate, participation, and the Howard Dean campaign has been a fundamental example of this. On the other hand, the actual election, to do it electronically, first is a tremendous class bias and educational bias. Second is absolutely not clear that can be done efficiently. Not that Florida has a great ability to control the vote, but still the networks are so insecure in technical terms that no one would accept an election that is fully electronically conducted. Yes, the most of the world is still not on the internet. Actually, at this point, 90% of the population in the world. And particularly the so-called digital gap is particularly important in developing countries. Everybody talks about the Chinese and Indian engineers. Everybody talks about Bangalore, the high-tech hub. But at the same time, of course, even in India, 97% of the Indian population is not connected to the internet. And that's exactly one of the characteristics I'm trying to analyze as part of this global network society. There is connection and disconnection at the same time. And the fact of not being connected, not just for personal purposes, but everything that is important is connected. Every global financial market, every major political system, every important thing in society is already connected through computer networks, not necessarily the internet. However, here there are two issues. First, social movements are also connected to the internet. Okay, so that's that. And second, the real issue in terms of inequality, to some extent, becomes as much from the disconnection as from the connection. Because once you are connected, the big inequality is what to do with your connection. And that's where educational and cultural inequality is multiplied and magnified by the inability to actually use the internet. If everybody would be connected to the internet, but we continue with the cultural and social inequality, I think inequality increases. And finally, your very well-taken comment about Al-Qaeda and networks. Yes and no. Here's the point. I studied Al-Qaeda a little bit, and then I published something on the matter. Al-Qaeda, most of the things that are done so-called on behalf of Al-Qaeda is certainly not Bin Laden, to be clear about. But it doesn't matter. What is precisely, this is the new form of politics, is precisely you take up some ideas, some values, some expression of revolt, and you build your own autonomous group. You are ready to die, or to kill, or both. And you call it on behalf of God. Then the CIA will say Al-Qaeda, and therefore Al-Qaeda keeps growing. Because, as you said, everything done on behalf of Islamic fundamentalism against the values and against the domination of the American hegemon around the world, etc., is Al-Qaeda, then everything becomes Al-Qaeda. So, to some extent, it's a combination of very different sources of violent attacks and resistance, both things, with the myth that has been created by the propaganda system of the Western world to justify all kind of other things, such as the Iraq war, that, as everybody knows, has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Now, yes, not before.
Three more questions.
Yes, I wanted to ask something about the Pulanza-Miliband debate that you mentioned in the beginning. And my comment was very interesting, but there's a lot of Miliband in your speech now, but I think there's little Pulanzas. And I had a question on that, because what comes out is a lot of cooperation from the segments of the structure of domination, military, financial, or the goal being cooperation, and very little contradiction or conflict between them. So even now with the Spanish moving towards the German-French axis and these movements, or contradictions between different segments of capital. In other words, the moments when this structure of domination tries to cohere and in the process loses part of it, sacrifices part of it, the things that Pulanzas was trying to bring out. And I wanted to comment on that.
Hi. I would like you to comment on U.S. hegemony. I'm sitting over here. U.S. hegemony. Is the U.S. just a dying nation state, network state? Is it a programmer or is it a switcher? And in relation to that, what is the power of the United Nations, and how do we state responsibility for example, the U.S. Actions in Iraq? How does this all sort of relate to your power theory?
There's actually one thing about networks and resistance which I think you haven't mentioned, which kind of started off as a dilemma in the beginning, that basically people who got connected to the network weren't speaking the language of the network. And by now, actually using local language, I think, has also kind of become a resistance form in the network by forming kind of local networks. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Should we just take two more? Can you manage two more?
I can manage them.
Yeah.
I don't know how much they can manage.
Give it. Just down here at the front, thank you. Of course, we're going to sleep by this time, and you've had your siesta, and you're ready to party.
A couple of observations. One is about the public sphere. You just mentioned about, in response to your earlier question, I'm just asking, if you take the Bible online, if you read the Bible online, there's a theory that it actually fundamentally questions the way of the religion that asks you to read, commands you to read. With a kind of hypertext and so on, you completely questions the religious authority or religious network, if you like. So in my view, kind of creates, actually ICTs creates a new sense of public sphere. Would you like to comment on that? And the second one is, just following on the US hegemony, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that ICANN, which is indirectly controlled by the US Department of Commerce, is responsible for assigning numbers of the entire world's internet hosts. So how would you see that in terms of rising or decline of states' power in this network society? Thank you.
One last question, yeah, please.
Hi. To what extent do you think that the new values being programmed into the network are true changes to the current power structure, or is just a reuse of the language to continue the power structure? And if that is the case, what would Radical Castell say about what can we do to do something to use a network society to change the power structure?
I'm afraid on that note, we must bring the questions to an end. Manuel?
Sure.
Last word?
Sure. Yes, I feel both Pulanzas and Miliband. And I would say that the last 20 years of my life have tried to make the synthesis between both perspectives, because I did find key elements on both sides of the debate. I would say that there is a structure, and this I will relate, in fact, to what has been mentioned on the power structure and the ability to influence the power structure. To make a simple statement, I see, on the one hand, the logic of networks as organizing very dynamically structural domination. In other words, if you don't do anything or you do very little, networks take things into their hands even without intervention. And this is now a global reality. It means what exactly? Well, it means Lula. It means look what Lula is able or not able to do once has accepted the reality that the financial networks imposing a certain type of discipline in economic policy, making sure that the public employment is going to be kept under control, or Lula having to make alliances with China in terms of the global negotiations in trade, a number of key elements which are part of the global, not to complicate the situation with other networks, or the alliance with O Globo, which is the largest media network in Brazil, which is now very much in alliance with Lula. This has all kind of implications. So networks process a structural domination. That's the connection. On the other hand, you can act on the networks on only one possibility, that you enter into the language that is able to be processed in these networks. For instance, the example of the Movement for Global Justice has been able to introduce in the media space a number of issues that had been taken up by by the media, and then by the public opinion, and ultimately processed through the political system. So that's why I think there is a possibility of intervention, but that is framed by the process of communication that is linked to this sphere of communication. Yet again, the sphere of communication is not a homogeneous thing. It's television and radio and newspapers, but then it's also the internet, and now it's wireless communication. And the farther you go from the core of control of the media and communication sphere, and the farther you have the capacity to generate counter movements within the structure, and that's something that could be thought much more in the instrumentalist policies and politics that Miliband tried to express. Now, the US hegemony. Well, frankly speaking, I think that people are, this is of course a huge topic, and I would say just for me what is essential. The US is not the superpower that people think. It's not. the U.S. can destroy, bomb everything, and then what? Once you have finished bombing, you have to do something with your bomb space. And they are trying to do something in Iraq. You think it's a demonstration of superpower domination? And in addition, they can only bomb little countries. They cannot bomb the real thing. They cannot bomb China. They cannot bomb Russia. They cannot bomb Pakistan. They cannot bomb themselves. So it's a very limited power. The only thing you can do is to bomb. Or Russia is a big nuclear power, sure, except that the only way they can use their power is to blow up the planet. What a power. And so on and so on. The U.S. does have a tremendous superiority in being a nodal point in the global network of science and technology. The strength of the United States is the American university system, which is the world system, and which ensures everything from the ability to generate technology and therefore new markets, new products, new processes, to the ability to generate military technology. Now, the United Nations in this context, well, I'm part of the UN, the Kofi Annan's Commission on the Global Civil Society and the United Nations that was appointed last year. We are delivering our report now. The United Nations is trying to find a way to go beyond the stalemate. The stalemate is the U.S. wants to use the UN as a tool, and if it does that, destroys the UN. The UN, on the other hand, cannot act really efficiently without the U.S. That's the contradiction. Now, I think, fortunately, agency is very important in this structure. I wrote in the last edition of my book that there was a contradiction between structure and agency in the current geopolitical system, which means concretely what? It means that everything is multilateral, network, global, interactive, but Bush doesn't know it. So that's the autonomy of agency. However, if the structure is a serious matter and not simply some abstract concept, ultimately means that reality comes back to haunt you. And reality is called nowadays, without having any prognosis on the matter, but nowadays it's called Kerry. And it's called 6 points of percentage behind Bush, behind Kerry in the opinion poll for the presidential election. And Kerry is saying exactly the contrary, you know, that Bush in that matter. We have to stabilize Iraq, we have to get out as soon as we can, and the United Nations has to take over, and we have to go back to multilateralism, and he is preaching Joe Nye's ideas constantly. So, you see, it depends on an election, but really so? Or it depends on society, and it depends on the capacity of society to counteract agencies. So there is where the spaces of autonomy are increasingly important. And when these spaces of autonomy start working on the media system and within the media system, then there is a debate, and ultimately structure takes back its rights over a completely distorted agency. I think this is difficult to understand in Britain because you're in such a peculiar situation that very soon you may be the only country occupying Iraq in the world. The Poles will stay with you forever. Local networks, yes. I think one of the critical matters here is in this network, global society, the thing is people and societies and consciousness are at the same time local and global, constantly interrelated. So, and these local networks are not simply face-to-face local networks connected electronic to the global network, they are also local networks. It's an extraordinary development of wireless grassroots communities nowadays. It's one of the most fast-growing processes is alternative forms of communication built around wireless. I mentioned the case of the political case in Barcelona around SMSs, but there are all kinds of things, Wi-Fi, et cetera, which are, people consider themselves anecdotes. Well, go to some villages in Spain, or go to Amsterdam, for that matter, or go to Rio de Janeiro at this point. There are all kinds of experiments where people are building systems of communication, which are local networks of communication that are hybrid, both face-to-face and wireless, and then they are connecting to the global network. One point about ICANN. yes, governments do not disappear from the world of regulation of the internet, but much of the regulation of the internet is very much the kind of regulation of the king of the universe of Saint-Exupéry's Petit Prince, meaning he orders every day that the sun must rise from the east. In other words, if you try through ICANN to go against what is the logic of internet, simply you will not be able to enforce the regulation. And in fact, in the Geneva Summit Conference, that was this interesting case in which the grassroots communities were, and the civil society in the information age were supporting the US government on ICANN against all the other governments, because all the other governments are much worse in that sense. And the key issue in Geneva, the only real issue for government there, was how to control the internet, how to create a very strong structure in the internet. And I have been in all kinds of commissions in Europe. I'm currently in the Europe Steering Program Committee. And the main concern for every government is how to control the internet. And then to diffuse it, but we diffuse it, not people. They are allergic to the internet because this is losing the control of communication. So for the time being, the American government, for a number of complicated ideological and business reasons, has been much better and using ICANN, but the only thing they are concerned about is global geopolitical security. The rest they don't care. And since this global geopolitical security is useless in terms of control, because of course the last thing Al-Qaeda does is organize itself on the internet. I mean, they're not that stupid. The Bible Online, I have worked a little bit on these matters and I have written something, not on the Bible, but on online evangelism and television evangelism. It's an interesting point here, because on the one hand, it's the ability to create a religious space which is truly global, interactive, much more powerful. On the other hand, by becoming part of a multi-thematic network, the ability to claim your space as a holy space disappears. You're the ultimate profane space when you coexist with all kind of porno stuff in the same global networks. And finally, power structure or reduced power. I think at this point, what we observe is the consciousness of all the power elites in every network to try to consolidate their power by connecting to the others, because they feel that by themselves they cannot hold power in their own network. Politicians with the media with the business with the governments, and so on and so on. Because at this point, the elusiveness of power and control is such that only by relating to others they can actually hope to keep control. But precisely by relating to the others, since everybody has its own viruses in its own network, they multiply exponentially the sources of opposition. By trying to reunify power, they unify opposition.
Many thanks.
Thank you.